Any of the advances in dentistry and medicine would not be possible without work done by researchers using animals. Working with animals poses countless dilemmas, ethical, practical, and emotional. Dr. Janice Kahn is someone who's worked on the front line of this kind of research. She had the honor at the most recent Quintessence Symposium of presenting on her postgraduate research. Afterwards, she spoke with our interviewer, Dr. Patrick Meany.
Janice, you've just given a postgraduate presentation at Quintessence here in Sydney. Mm-hmm. What I found interesting, Janice, was that we see a lot of lecturers come mm-hmm. to our shores mm-hmm. and they talk about the experimental studies and mm-hmm. we just listen to the mm-hmm. presentation without really thinking about what's involved. What was special about your presentation was you told us exactly how you went about manipulating these dogs. Mm-hmm. Let's go through that. For instance, one thing that I was wondering was how close is the dog model to humans? Can you really use that data?
From my convener's study, or his PhD, in Judge 2006, we did find similarities between the bite force magnitudes, even though, yes, dogs do bite at quite high force, but some heavy bruxes do also. And also, the whole cyclic pattern can be quite similar. And also, tooth-to-tooth contact time is also similar. Yes, dogs do not have lateral excursion as much so as human beings because their canines lock them into a more vertical position. However, it does serve as probably as close that we can get an animal to a human model. So for dogs, we do understand there is differences anatomically and bone physiological response, like dogs actually heal and have osseointegration happen a lot faster than human beings. But in terms of the more biting time, magnitude, cyclic pattern of biting, it is actually been found to be quite similar to human beings.
And what did you do exactly? You got some dogs, or two dogs, was it?
Two dogs, yes.
And what brand were they?
They were greyhounds. Unfortunately, it's a very horrible thing that human beings do, that they actually kill greyhounds if they can't run fast enough. So these dogs have been allocated for research, not just for dental research, but also for medical research as well. And we had to go through a very difficult animal ethics approval process. And so by the end of the 4 months of scrutiny, I actually know about what size needle they actually inject into the dogs, what kind of dog food they eat, and what size rooms they have to live in, and yeah, planning for vets to go in and brush their teeth every single day. All that little gritty details was fairly involved in doing animal research. Yeah. It is tricky.
So you put four implants in, and what's that like? Easy, hard?
It was actually quite tricky. The extractions itself was very difficult because
they charge a lot, vets, when you have to have
extractions. We didn't have a vet to do it. We had a periodontist do it. I will mention her name is Dr. Melinda Newham. And we were in the room and it was definitely very strenuous taking these teeth out. And after that, the implant placement, the bone is very different to work with as human beings. Also with a dog lying on its side with intubation, it's difficult to work with, to get orientation and everything correct. But she's done a lovely job on that. I think a couple of times it was tricky that we had vets there watching over the whole GA session. And a couple of dogs actually stopped breathing halfway through. And I've to say my heart was pounding when that moment happened. Apparently it happens quite often in GA sessions for animals, for dogs as well. So thankfully we have two very experienced vets. They're helping us with the whole procedure, and that it went after that point fairly uneventful.
Then you had to restore the implants, and you described your utter joy at having to fabricate this
special tray. What we did first was we used putty resin to just take a very brief shape of the arch. Then after that, we had to construct some really large size special trays, and probably a bit oversized because there's so much undercut in the dog's teeth, especially canines, and also in his mandible. It's actually quite interesting because we cannot really follow the protocol we normally do for human beings because we have to cater for various things. So I followed up, why don't we use alginate in all the natural teeth areas so there is a bit more give, and then use PVS where we really need it to be very accurate because we're not going to want to put the dogs under GA again to have to take another new set of impressions if our first one didn't go right. Another tricky thing with it was there is a huge massive tongue with also a big intubation tube. So we had to have three of us, one mixing materials, one getting the tongue and cheek and everything ready to go, another one loading the tray. It was interesting. When you look back, I think we were quite innovative in the way we approached it. We kind of attacked a little problem at a time as it comes up. And I guess this is what research is about. You never know what's around the corner and you have to accommodate
for it. Well, the photograph of the resulting impression, I think only one word, it's just weird to look at. But I guess if you can take an impression of four implants in a greyhound, you can do anything in real life.
I have to say I'm blessed with tiny fingers and hands, so even sometimes tricky situation, I can get around it. But it is a completely different kind of scenario we have to do. So I think we did the best we could for the dogs. And the best part about it is we've got a lovely technician, Mr. Clay Taylor, who helped us construct the crowns, and he did a brilliant job with the occlusion. So obviously our bite registration impressions were great. So at the time of insert, we didn't have to do hardly any adjustments to ensure there was contact, which we're thankful of, because each time we had to check for occlusal contact, we have to extubate the dog, check the contact is not right, adjust, intubate again, and that had to go back and forth a couple of times to get everything perfect.
Okay, we might leap ahead to your conclusions, because I think you installed some crowns in hyperocclusion, and then the dogs were sacrificed, and you had the pleasant job of preparing the skulls, and then you attached strain gauges to them and carried out a series of measurements. What have you found so far? I realise your research isn't finished, but have you formed any initial impressions?
I think at this stage, from the data we've collected, that as each implant is loaded individually, the strain does go up, but more so in the more posterior implant than compared to the mesial implants. And with that, up to 500 newtons so far, even though we've tested in this range, and to be honest, that's probably the more average range that the animal will bite, because it's not going to use its peak range all the time. We have found that the strain gauge measurements to be lying at the moment at 500 newtons, about 800 microstrains.
Now, what's a microstrain? I missed that bit.
Microstrain is just a unit of measuring bone, the amount of change over length. So we use micro in front is because the strain is small, so it's just a micro unit of strain. And we use what we call Rosette strain gauges. So it's actually three strain gauges stacked into one. And so it measures the strain in three directions, X, Y, and Z axes. And we then calculate what is the principal strain measurement and direction that's resulted. And from what we can see, at 500 newtons, the highest strain we have recorded is about 832 microstrains. Using the data set we've got, even if we put a predictive curve to it, which is based on a statistical formula called Michaelis-Menten, and at 1,000 newtons, which is probably more like the realistic peak that a dog or animal will bite at the weight of the dogs we've got now, the maximum strain will probably reach about 1,400 microstrains. Now, I must also add, these are dry skulls. So in actual fact, the dry skulls will generally more brittle, and also under loading, the strain values created is actually higher than if it was a wet skull. So therefore, this actually provides us with an extra safety margin for our research, that even though we're measuring 800 microstrains at 500 newtons, in fact, if the animal was in an enclosed biological system when the skull is wet, it may even fall less than that. So from what we can see is, if it is one implant replacement per tooth, the occlusal overload situation probably will have a lot of mechanical complications, but in terms of biologically, bone loss-wise, probably it won't be a huge issue, as in bone loss may not be associated with occlusal overload. However, if we were to apply restorations in a cantilever type of situation, that will become probably one of the concerns, because even if you bite at 1,000 newtons per se, the load that will be experienced at the implant supporting the cantilever unit will be higher than 1,000 newtons because of a cantilever moment. So I would suspect that for the next continuation on this kind of research, it will be interesting to see what will happen in a cantilever situation. I think that will be where clinical significance will come, hopefully, instead of anecdotally, we should cantilever or not in particular clinical situation. Hopefully, we'll have some evidence to support to do things one way or the other.
Well, good luck with that. Good luck with the dogs. Yeah. And maybe we'll catch up when you're onto the next stage.
Yeah, thank you very much.